But first, Drew McGarry. He's a journalist, humor columnist, and novelist. Drew's probably best known for his work at GQ magazine and his hilarious columns for the sports site Deadspin. Drew's most popular Deadspin feature was his annual NFL Teams preview called Why Your Team Sucks. Each year, eager Deadspin readers would await their chance to join Drew in lambasting their favorite team. But last fall, Drew resigned from Deadspin. He joined his colleagues in a much-publicized walkout protesting the new management and direction of the site. Since then, he's continued his work for GQ and put the finishing touches on his latest novel, Point B. However, the book and Drew's entire life was put on hold after a very serious health scare.
I suffered a catastrophic brain hemorrhage in December of 2018 after I had hosted an award show for Deadspin, where I was working at the time. We were in a private room doing karaoke because we were being fancy pants. And then I went out into a hall, and I don't remember what happened after that. I had the blanks filled in after the fact, but I collapsed. And so I had to be rushed to one hospital where they thought I was just drunk. I was not just drunk. And then they did a CAT scan on me and realized that I was in very, very grave danger and got me to a different hospital because I required a certain brain surgery. Anyway, I was in a coma for 2 weeks after that. I was in the hospital for another 3 weeks after that. And I finally got out, which was good because when the accident happened, I was two chapters away from finishing the first draft of Point B. So that was very nice to be able to finish that and not leave it hanging before I shuffled off the mortal coil.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you mentioned you were having karaoke. Do you recall what song you sang?
I do. I remember intimately. It was You Got Lucky by Tom Petty. Like, I don't know about you, but certain people have karaoke staples
Yes.
that they usually rely on. Like, I'm good with Purple Rain and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
If I had had a beer and was feeling frisky, I was like, I'll try something I haven't done before. And then I had some pizza and I had a beer, and then I collapsed. But I did manage to sing the song, so that was nice. Yeah.
How fitting that it was that song that you sang.
Right, yeah, yeah. The joke I made was that it's either fitting or ironic, depending upon how you look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your recovery process like?
Well, one was just doing nothing because the brain just needs time to heal on its own. And then I had to get out of bed, which was its own adventure. So I had to go to physical therapy at the hospital and back home, both inpatient and outpatient, so that I could learn to walk steadily again. Like, my mind was still there when I woke up. Everything, all my memories were there. My identity was still there. But, like, certain things, like, I couldn't stand up for very long without feeling nauseous, because that happens when you have a traumatic brain injury. And otherwise, it was really just this gradual process to get my brain just back to where it could do basic civilization tasks all over again. And, of course, there is no civilization now, so it was all for nothing.
Yeah. So how did this experience change the way you live your life?
I mean, it changed it physically because, like I said, I'm half deaf now.
Yeah.
It affected me in other sensory ways that I'm going to write about down the road. I think if you talk to anybody who's suffered a TBI, and there are millions of us, 1.5 million every year, it can affect your personality. It can affect your mood. In my case, my mood was just a touch worse. It was obvious to my wife and to my kids, but it wasn't clear to me. And so I had to understand that I was somewhat blind to the ways that I had changed and to rely on them to see me through so that I could be a better version of this new self that I am.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you'd written the first draft of Point B before this happened. So how did this episode influence the rest of the writing of Point B when you went back to it to write the next draft?
It actually didn't. Because I had already written about what had happened to me. I'm going to write about more. There were some thoughts I had about death that went into the book, but not a tremendous amount because I had the whole story laid out before I got hurt. And I still believed in the story and I still loved it. And I didn't wake up thinking, well, I have to change everything now because I have this new outlook on life. It was, I can't wait to finish this. I felt as if the coma was this really annoying interruption in the middle of the process that I didn't want to be there. So oddly, I was like, I just wanted to get back to where it was, which sort of also factors in the story of my recovery, because I want everything to be exactly the same as it was prior to my injury, point B included. But I, of course, was not the same. Yeah. And again, I had to accept that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about your protagonist in point B, Anna Huff?
Yes, the brave Anna Huff. Okay, Anna loses her sister to suicide. Well, this is a world where everyone can teleport. And so imagine if the man who's bullying you in cyberspace can actually come teleport right to your house and do so. This is a man who menaced Anna's sister and essentially drove her into death by suicide. And so Anna, grieving and devastated by what the world of teleportation has wrought upon her, seeks shelter at a fabulous elite prep school called Druskin, where students are not allowed to teleport. And in the course of that, she falls in love with her roommate, Lara Kirsch. Lara Kirsch disappears. And so the fact that she's fallen in love with a girl who disappears, and the fact that her sister's killer is still out there somewhere, gives her all the reason she needs to scheme and figure out ways to bust out of Druskin and to port around the world and to chase down both love and revenge in equal measure. And that's my elevator pitch for you.
Yeah, that's a good elevator pitch. You had an actual physicist, Matt Bellis, physicist this book for you, as you so poetically put it. Matt taught you about quantum mechanics. How did Matt's knowledge and what you learned from him, how did that influence your novel?
Well, obviously, you can't teleport. You're not going to be able to teleport. But if you could, if you teleported, when your body disappears, you leave a vacuum. And that vacuum has to be filled. Well, what does it get filled by? Air. And all that air would get sucked into that spot in an instant, and it would make a clap. It would make a noise. It would go poof. At the same time, when you reappeared, you would be displacing air, and that air would need somewhere to go. And so what would happen is you would give off a port wind. The air would shove out from the place where you appeared and blow onto other people. And so those were two really big things that makes it believable. Because what happens with sci-fi is that the reader will give you one thing. If you're like, okay, I can teleport using my phone, all right, fine. But you better believe everything else that happens around it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I talked to Matt and ended up learning more about atomic displacement than I thought I would.
Mm, yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt. And if you could set it up too, that would be great.
Yes, I could do that. Okay, Anna and her best friend at Druskin Academy, Paul Bammert, have figured out a way to teleport off campus, but this is their first night testing the technology under cover of darkness without school officials noticing. So, are you ready?
Yes.
All right. It was getting dark enough now to provide Anna and Bammert with a bit of cover, but not so dark and late as to have security roaming around with mag lights. Behind the Druskin Infirmary, there was a decent-sized patch of woods where kids would go to get high and drink hard soda. They called it the crater. We shouldn't do it right in this spot, Anna said when they arrived. It needs to be offset a little. I concur. They walked another 10 yards west and turned south, following the towering Harkness Wall, stepping over and around felled trees that had been euthanized after emerald ash borers had stuck through the perimeter. Autumn was coming on strong now, every step they took causing the dead leaves to crackle and snap. The wind grew hostile. Anna got dizzy from looking around so much to make sure they were alone and unseen. She needed 8 more sets of eyes to feel secure. Here, she said, stopping next to a thick oak tree. Bammert hung the blanket on one of the branches, and she slipped underneath. The branch broke, and the 15-pound blanket tackled her like an oncoming linebacker. Are you okay? Bammert asked. I'm fine. This is fine. They hung the blanket on a sturdier branch this time. She ducked underneath, opened the map, zoomed in on her location, and chose a pin 2 feet away from where she was currently standing. A fly landed on Anna's shoulder. She laughed out loud before shooing it away. She hit port, took a step, and felt the shiver. Now this was proper porting. No burning, no needles. She had never been so happy to feel so cold. She took her step into the hole, and for a fraction of a second, the cold encased her. You didn't pass through space-time, so much as space-time passed through you. It was like a sneeze, a strange reflex that sealed your eyes shut and would probably kill you if it lasted any longer than it did. The great vacuum of air created by your exit from this plane sucked the blanket toward the void and left it stick straight for a millisecond before it flared back out and plummeted to the ground. That heavy covering was enough to keep the port clap from echoing beyond the woods. Anna appeared again right next to the blanket, the gust from her reappearance blowing Bamert's tie over his shoulder. He covered his face to keep from squealing with delight. "It works!" he whispered. "It works." They looked up at the Harkness wall, its battlements blocking out the coming moonlight. "Think we'll get past it?" Anna asked him. "Sure as sunlight we will."
There's a lot of funny dialogue between the characters, but you also tackle some very serious issues, such as immigration, surveillance capitalism, and hate crimes. How big a challenge was it for you to weave back and forth between the comedy and the dramatic elements?
That part actually wasn't very hard, because you and I, we live in this crap every day. So it's like, and especially now, you can't avoid it. There's no avoiding it. It's just smothering all this news, and it's omnipresent, and there's no way to build a world that resembles this Earth, but a few years removed from now, that is not very much like the insanity of right now, because I don't think that insanity is going away anytime soon, no matter what happens with the pandemic. I think it's lasting, and I think it's permanent. It's a kind of societal brain damage that I did not expect, even when back before my own brain was damaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were one of the founding contributors to the NFL humor website, Kissing Susie Colbert. And then you joined Deadspin, where you unleashed your finely honed McGarry-esque sense of humor on the wide world of sports. Why do you like making fun of sports?
Because sports is so eminently self-serious, it deserves to have its ass kicked every day. Even now, like, there's so much sports news being left on the table right now that I think Deadspin would have covered well, but, you know, leagues experimenting with, you know, figuring out ways to come back, and how ESPN, you know, has to essentially lean on 10 hours of Jordan Filler documentary to create its own sports news ecosystem.
First of all, there's no backstabbing going on here, okay? Okay? You understand me when I say that? There's no backstabbing going on here.
You know, all the stuff is really interesting, but it's not being covered the way it ought to be covered because, of course, the people who are making all the mistakes are either the places that are in charge of doing the coverage or are beholden to the to the places that are messing up through access and broadcasting rights and all of that stuff. We always agreed that Deadspin was less a site about sports, but really about sports culture. And right now, sports culture is very weird and is responding to this outbreak in very typically sports culturist ways, you know, with equal bits of machismo and ignorance and blind stupidity and pretend compassion, you know, in ways that deserve to be called out.
Mm-hmm. Last year, Deadspin all but dismantled after new management decided to interfere with the site's editorial direction. You were the marquee name who resigned. Can you talk about your take on the situation?
Yeah, I can talk about it. Yeah, sure. I think we all knew things were going poorly with our new owners at Great Hill, that they bought all our sites, but they didn't particularly like them or even know what the point of them was. I don't even know. I really don't know why they bought the sites. But it became increasingly clear that come hell or high water, they were going to make us change the site in ways that we just simply didn't want to do. So in that way, we sort of saw the end coming, but I don't think any of us anticipated it happening over the course of 2 days with all of us quitting in unison. It certainly was not premeditated. But once Barry Pachesky was fired because he, you know, jokingly put a bunch of non-sports stories on the front page of the website, then the guy beneath him, my friend Tom Lay, resigned. And once Tom resigned, it felt as if the spine of the site had just been ripped out, and there just wasn't going to be anything left. Because so many times over the years, we had just knuckled down and done our work and tried our best to ignore all the BS going on above us. But then there was this very short time frame around Halloween of last year where it became instantly untenable and we all had to quit.
Mm-hmm. It seems like right now during this COVID-19 quarantine with all major sports on hold, that a site that wasn't just sticking to sports, like as Deadspin was, would drive more traffic.
You would think.
And yeah, yep. Getting back to the idea of making fun of sports, is there a particular sport that you find is low-hanging fruit that you enjoy making fun of?
Yeah, the NFL. Of course it's the NFL. I mean, the NFL and college football take themselves more seriously than any other sport.
Speaking of the NFL, one of the things you're most known for is your annual NFL preseason column series, Why Your Team Sucks. Can you talk a little bit about this concept and how you came up with it?
Yeah, I remember back in the Wild West days of the internet, like around 1998, because I'm a Vikings fan, and that was the year they went 15-1 and went to the NFC Championship game, and I was on the sporting news forums, and I would troll other teams' message boards by writing a lengthy post about why the Vikings are better than you. I, of course, would pay the ultimate karmic punishment for that. But but I just remember that previewing or talking about teams in a way that was completely derogatory was fun because the average preseason preview of a team is always full of hope. And when every player feels better than they have in years and, this rookie could be an up-and-comer. And so they're always giving you reasons to hope. And those hopes usually get dashed within the first half of week one. And all fans know this. So, you know, the instant that we started the series at Deadspin, people started writing in right away because there's no team that NFL fans love to hate more than their own.
Drew McGarry, thank you very much.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Drew McGarry is a journalist, humor columnist, and the author of the novel Point B. Find out more about Drew at wpr.org/beta.
So I want to capture a range of voices, a humorous voice, a comic voice, or a deeply grieving voice, and sometimes even within the same story, because we all have that inside of ourselves.
Mary South joins us to talk about her debut short story collection, You Will Never Be Forgotten. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.